from your North Carolina Reading Service. For our blind and print-impaired audience, we present the Indie Week. Our issue today, from July 13th, 2022, read by John Federson. And here we go. Opening up by from Carol Espinosa Jane, The Housing Puzzle. With the implementation of the Wake Bus Rapid Transit BRT system well underway, Raleigh's City Council has begun to approve and finalize a new zoning district to address development and affordability across the city's public transit corridors. City officials hope the new Transit Overlay District, TOD, will create walkable, vibrant districts with retail and affordable housing centered around the city's upcoming BRT stations in Raleigh's New Bern Avenue, Western Boulevard, Southern and Northern Transit Corridors by allowing developers to build taller structures in exchange for including needed amenities, such as affordable housing. But many Raleigh residents are afraid the new TOD won't do enough in certain areas of the city, with some saying it will hasten gentrification and make the potential for displacement of residents worse, especially in that Western Boulevard corridor. The debate came to a head at a July 5th public hearing when around two dozen residents showed up to the council chamber to oppose the proposed TOD for a new BRT plan for Western Boulevard and the Southern Corridors. But these residents insist they're not against public transit and growth in Raleigh. They just have concerns. Reeves Peeler, a member of the Wake County Housing Justice Coalition, a group of activists who seek to address gentrification and advocate for affordable, equitable housing through grassroots organizing, said, "When we were talking about the Western BRT the other night during the hearing, I can't tell you how many times people were saying, 'Oh, you're anti-transit. What, you hate buses? You hate seeing Raleigh grow?' It's like, no, that's absolutely not the point of this." The July 5th hearing focused on proposals to rezone parts of the existing area around the confirmed BRT routes on Western Boulevard and along the Southern BRT corridor. On Western, that's about 666 acres between downtown Raleigh and downtown Cary. And in the Southern Corridor, it's about 517 acres connecting downtown Raleigh to stations in Garner along the largely industrial South Wilmington Street. Despite the backlash the council received from a handful of public commenters who were allotted 8 minutes to speak, the council unanimously approved the TOD for the Southern Corridor. The Western Boulevard Corridor vote was pushed back to the August 16th City Council meeting. Matthew Clem, senior planner for the Raleigh Planning and Development Department, told the council that the TOD is designed to regulate development along the BRT corridors on Western and the Southern Corridor and to address potential gentrification in the area might face by building more affordable housing. Clem said the TOD includes, quote, another piece of the affordable housing puzzle with the implementation of a density bonus along rezoned property. Now, according to the TOD guidelines, rent-controlled units will receive a 50% height bonus if 20% of additional units are affordable for people with an income of less than 60% of the average median income, that's the AMI, and it will remain affordable for 30 years. Developers can receive a 30% height bonus for small-scale commercial uses. Overall, new construction can be taller and closer together. Josh Bradley, a commenter at the public hearing and a candidate running at large for a city council seat this fall, said, "I don't think it's enough. Right now, with the way the city's growing, we've got a lot of people that are living here under bridges. It's potentially good. We're getting all this business coming in. Apple's coming in. A lot of people are coming here. But there's a whole lot of people that have lived here for a long time that are in situations where they can't afford to anymore. With Raleigh, one of the fastest growing cities in the country, Wake County Housing Justice Coalition advocates say they are not against the council doing more to increase access to public transit, but they were clear they have concerns. Haley Kinsler, one of the public speakers at the hearing, said that while they are in favor of increased public transit, they aren't seeing enough guarantees and certainties with the BRT plan and the rezoning process that affordable housing will remain in the area, saying, I see the Food Line is being rezoned. I see my favorite restaurants. All the stores that I go to are being rezoned, and we don't have a design yet. I just need more guarantees for myself and my neighbors that we're going to be protected because so many of us live in naturally occurring affordable housing. I don't think that an additional two stories for 60% AMI for just 30 years is enough. I think we need more. Yolanda Taylor, a community lawyer and member of the Wake County Housing Justice Coalition, tells Indy that with Raleigh's expected business and economic boom, rent prices are very likely to go up, and the city must get more creative in ensuring affordable housing. Taylor saying there is such a thing called transit-induced gentrification, a walkable community that's connected to light rail transit is going to be in high demand, and by the very nature of going in there, connecting transit to housing in retail to housing, connecting transit to housing, to retail, to office space, that itself is going to increase the property value. According to Taylor, residents are right to be concerned because they have experienced mass displacement and mass gentrification due to increased development in downtown and other places. Quote, we want to say we're not anti-transit. We understand the need for transit, especially in an area like Raleigh that's going to see unprecedented growth, unquote. During the public hearing, Council Member Nicole Stewart said the Raleigh BRT program is one piece of the puzzle of the City Council's long-term affordable housing plan, and that the TOD is not the only way Raleigh is addressing housing inequality across the city. Stewart said, the rezoning is ensuring that we can encourage affordable housing through density along our transit line so we don't do what Charlotte did along their metro line, which has put a whole bunch of very expensive high-rise housing. We want to make sure we get that affordable housing built in there. Councilmember David Cox asked, how many naturally existing affordable housing units already exist within the proposed BRT corridors? Clem said city staff would follow up with the council with more statistics. Cox went on, that's a major piece of the puzzle we're missing. We don't know how much naturally occurring affordable housing there is in these corridors. We don't know how much we will potentially use and how many people would be affected by losing that. The only guarantee that we have with these TOD standards is 20% of 50%, which is at the most 10% of the units would be affordable at 60% of AMI or less. Once again, AMI is median income, average median income. Because local governments in North Carolina don't have the authority to manage inclusionary zoning from developers under state law, Peeler and Taylor say it makes sense the city council would work its way around that with a density bonus. But both say it isn't enough to combat the rise of housing inequality in Raleigh because it is ultimately optional for developers. Taylor says the developer doesn't have to do it. It's all about creating new affordable housing, but when you look at the percentage of what's going to meet that need, it's very small. And we were concerned about the preservation of naturally occurring affordable housing. What are we going to do also to preserve as we build new? While both Peeler and Taylor acknowledge the rezoning around the BRT corridors on Western Boulevard and the Southern Corridor seem to be set in stone, Raleigh residents should also be aware of other rezoning and development projects around the city that could affect low-income housing, like the Heritage Park and Moore Square redevelopment and the large parks bond that will appear before voters on the fall ballot. Peeler says, "It takes years to redevelop something. Where do those people go in the meantime? Is the city going to set aside an apartment for them to live at the same rent while their old place gets redeveloped? Certainly not. There's no legal mechanism for that, and there's no history of that happening." Tomasi McDonald usually writes about Durham, and this column is one called Collateral Damage. Zan Person, the lovely child who was killed 3 years ago on a late summer evening while traveling with his family for a snow cone, would have turned 12 this year. 3 years ago, the hopes and dreams of the 9-year-old were shattered by a barrage of gunfire during a drive-by shooting in North Durham, just one day after the child learned he was going to start as quarterback for his youth football team. This month, the hopes and dreams of 27-year-old Antonio Little Tony Davenport were also erased when a federal jury found him and an accomplice guilty of firing the gunshots that killed Zion. Davenport was convicted on one count each of murder in aid of racketeering, possession of a firearm in furtherance of a violent crime, and discharging or possession of a firearm to commit a violent crime in aid of racketeering that caused Zion's death. Looking at a potential 2 life sentences plus 10 years in prison, life as a free man is pretty much over for Davenport, who had just signed a recording contract with Forever Rich Records, a division of Atlantic Records, as a member of the rap trio known as 83 Babies. It's as if Davenport were on the precipice of realizing his lifelong dream of fame and fortune as a member of 83 Babies and lost it all in a hail of senseless, retaliatory gunfire. According to the meticulous, nearly gavel-to-gavel reporting of the court case by the News and Observer's Virginia Bridges, the rap trio before Davenport's arrest performed a harsh brand of lyrics that glorifies black gang violence in New York, Florida, California, and other places, and posted photos on social media with girls, cash, and fancy cars. Davenport, with the fleeting success he enjoyed as a rapper, was living a life he didn't know was possible, he told Bridges during an interview. "I had wanted to be a rapper since I was 9 years old," he reportedly said. Sadly, Davenport had already sold his soul to the 8-Trey Gangster Crips, a criminal street gang accused of racketeering activities that fund the enterprise through the sale of narcotics, bank fraud, witness tampering, and other illegal activities, according to an indictment. Federal prosecutors accused the street gang of maintaining control over illegal activities occurring within their territory by keeping rival gang members and the public at large in fear of the enterprise and in fear of its members and associates through threats of violence and through the use of intimidation, violence, threats of violence, assault, and other violent crimes. 2 years ago, on September 9th, U.S. Magistrate Judge Joy Elizabeth Peake denied Davenport's request to attend his father's visitation and graveside service. Peake acknowledged that while Davenport's desire to attend his father's burial service was understandable, the charges filed him were, quote, extraordinarily serious and reflect ongoing gang-related violence. Peake also explained that, given the evidence presented during a detention hearing, even a funeral visitation could become a site for continuation of that gang-related violence. Davenport actually made it easy for police to charge him with a fatal drive-by shooting. Peake, in issuing her denial that prohibited him from going to the father's service, noted that Davenport was wearing an electronic monitoring device as a condition of his release from jail when he was involved in Zion's death. As the Indy previously reported, there is an ongoing gang feud that started in 2017 between the 8-Trey gangster Crips in Bragtown, of which Davenport is a member, and the non-traditional O Block and 8 AM gangs. Maria Joses, a retired FBI agent who is challenging Durham's incumbent sheriff in the November election, told the Indy, "We're seeing shootings involving these two entities. It started with the shooting death of Kyle Fisher, whose alias is the letter O. O Block thinks the 8-Trey gangster Crips were responsible for Fisher's death." Bridges had noted that since 2017, O Block is connected with other gangs, primarily the United Blood Nation sets that include Southside, Brentwood, and 9-Trey gangsters. Meanwhile, 8 AM members are former 8-Trey gangster Crips who formed a new crew. It's hard to conjure up sympathy for Davenport, who thought he and two accomplices were taking aim at a Ford Escape occupied by O Block members who had assaulted him days before at the streets of South Point Mall and then shared a video on social media to belittle him and the 8-Trey gangster Crips. And little has changed since Zion's death. In fact, it's worse. On June 29th, WRAL premiered a nearly 30-minute documentary, Durham Under Fire, that featured Zion as the face of violent crime in the city. Zion's grandmother, Sandra Person, who spoke with the Indy in 2019 after Zion's death, was featured in that documentary, saying, "I can still see it to this day. My baby lying in bed with a hole in his head. And they even said he tried to hang on, but if he would have made it, he would have been a vegetable, you know. So I guess God seen fit for him to take him home." That documentary aired 2 days after jury selection for Davenport's trial and painted a dismal picture of gun violence in the Bull City. Last year, 50 homicides were the most in the city since 1995. Police have reported 1,100 shootings over the past year and a half, meaning the city experiences 2 shootings each day. There are 111 vacancies among the police department's 537 sworn officer positions, and after George Floyd's murder, no one's rushing to fill the open spots. The documentary notes that during the Black Lives Matter protest, the word defund was painted in giant yellow letters on East Main Street, right in front of the downtown police headquarters, and remained there for 13 months before it was removed. Durham Mayor Elaine O'Neill, a former judge and retired law school dean before she was elected last year as the city's first black woman mayor, says, "I cannot imagine going to work and having defund the judge or defund the dean and people not being hurt and scared by that." At the heart of the documentary is the question, why is gun violence so bad in Durham? The documentary focused on the law enforcement side of the issue with the unstated axiom that the only way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. But little attention was focused on another axiom that's gaining traction. The only way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good-paying job with benefits. It's difficult to shoot someone at 7 p.m. if the perpetrator also has to work a third-shift job that starts at 11. Durham District Attorney Satana DeBerry, interviewed in that documentary, points to personal choices, but she also points to structural poverty. It's no surprise that much of the gunfire happens in the city's most underfunded communities. Paul Scott, an activist minister and founder of the Black Messiah Movement, says, "You shove them into public housing and then you turn your backs on them." DeBerry, who was first elected in 2019, promised criminal justice reforms that included opting to not aggressively prosecute low-level offenses that have resulted in mass incarceration, and the over-policing of black and brown communities. According to the documentary, she's also wiped clean the records of hundreds of children who were charged as adults. She says, of course I'm tough on violent crime. Still, the word on the streets is, if you want to get away with the murder, do it in Durham. The documentary reports that before DeBerry was elected, Durham in 2016 through 2017 had a felony conviction rate of 51%, not including plea bargains. During DeBerry's tenure, that number dropped to 33%. DeBerry explains, we don't prioritize conviction rates. What we prioritize is working on the most serious and violent crime. But the documentary also notes that the Bull City's current conviction rate for first-degree murder is 24%. By comparison, Wake County has a 67% conviction rate, and the statewide average is 45%. DeBerry says that gun violence is not unique to Durham. Quote, violent crime is up nationwide, and so this idea that Durham is exceptionally violent is simply not true. But that's little solace for people like Zion's grandmother, Sandra Person. City leaders, she says, have to figure out a way to get the community back. Though Davenport's action that led to Zion's death may prompt little or no sympathy, he and the child he was convicted of murdering still both represent the promise and potential that has been marred and destroyed by the glorification of gun culture. Say their names indeed. City Council member and Mayor Pro Tem Mark Anthony Middleton says at the end of the documentary, Zion Person, the efficacy of this government and the greatness of our city will be measured by whether or not Zion can go get an icy. From Jasmine Gallup now, summer running. For most political candidates in the Triangle, the first round of elections was over in May. Winners celebrated their victories and losers trudged along the roadsides to collect campaign signs. But for four candidates for two seats on the Cary Town Council, the race is still on. Of the three town council seats that were up for grabs in May, only one candidate secured enough votes to avoid a runoff election. That's incumbent Jennifer Robinson, who won District A with 75% of the vote. In North Carolina, a few nonpartisan municipal elections, like Cary's, require runoff elections to take place when candidates don't earn enough votes to be declared the winner outright. Under state statute, in municipalities using this election and runoff method, candidates have to win at 50% of the vote to secure a victory. In the race for the at-large seat, the first place finisher was Carissa Johnson, a Democrat who secured about 40% of the vote. This month, she faces Republican Ken George, who earned 39%. In a surprising upset, incumbent Ed Yerha, who is unaffiliated, fell to his challengers in May, finishing in last place with 21% of the vote. In the race for District C, Republican Renee Miller finished in first place with 28.5%, barely edging out unaffiliated incumbent Jack Smith, who earned 28.04%. Miller beat longtime councilmember Smith by just 45 votes, and the two face off again on July the 26th. As Cary grows rapidly and politics become more partisan, this month's election will determine the direction the city heads in for at least the next 2 years. One council member, Ya Liu, is also running for the State House, so if she's elected in November, a new member will be appointed to fill her spot. On the current council, four members are unaffiliated with moderate voting records that often lean liberal on issues of development and conservative on issues of finance. Robinson, a registered Republican, is also part of that cohort. Two members, Liu and Lori Bush, are registered Democrats and solidly liberal, but they also tend to vote based on the local landscape rather than along party lines. Devin Ross, a local advocate for affordable housing with the nonprofit One Wake, says, on the whole, the current council is fairly moderate and has traditionally been nonpartisan and focused on local issues. What's unusual about this race is how national politics are filtering down. This year, partisan politics have infiltrated the race, giving an edge to candidates backed by the Democratic and Republican parties. Both unaffiliated candidates, Yerha and Smith, trailed their partisan opponents. One explanation for the results could be the delay in the election, says Smith. Kerry's town council elections typically take place as standalone races in odd-numbered years. But this year, because of pandemic-related delays in reporting the census data, the 2021 election was rescheduled to take place at the same time as a partisan primary. Smith says, it's the first time in recent history we've had a race moved into a partisan primary year. Both parties had candidates that just wanted to ride the coattails of the organization. I talked to people that voted, and they said, look, we love what you've done for Kerry, but this is a bigger issue now. We have to send a message to the country to stop this growing hate. The result of the runoff elections could create a council that leans more heavily toward liberal or conservative ideals. Hot-button political issues like LGBTQ rights and immigration have also become part of voters' considerations. One flyer left on doors in Kerry this week urged people to vote for Ken George to protect the city from events like the Apex Pride Festival. The flyer claims, this event was aimed to sexualize, groom, and indoctrinate our children, clearly a Marxist assault on our family values. The Democratic majority in the Kerry Town Council, quote, risks Kerry going the way of Apex. And Equality NC, which endorsed Johnson, George's opponents, is a radical organization, continues the ad. If Miller and George win, the council would be composed of three Republicans, two unaffiliated members, and two Democrats. The two candidates, along with Robinson, could significantly influence the council majority to start voting more conservatively on issues of development, public safety, and taxes. Neither candidate is an extreme conservative, but their election could mean the town council slows its current course. So now they break down these by the races. District C race. Who is Renee Miller? Miller said in an email that she was not available for an interview, but has written on her website about prioritizing public safety, low taxes, infrastructure, and strategic growth. Miller writes that Kerry will be kept safe by providing first responders with proper equipment and training, and by keeping pay competitive. She says the town council needs to preserve Kerry's hometown feel, quote, welcoming spirit and charm by balancing the rights of property owners with excessive rezoning requests. Miller adds the city should guarantee our current citizens' needs are met before adding more developments. Also in that race, who is Jack Smith? Smith is a moderate council member who has served on the town council for the past 32 years, a fact he admits didn't boost his chances in the most recent election. And he says, I'm not blind. People say, well, he's been there 32 years. Maybe it's time for someone else. Am I the same Jack Smith who ran in the 80s? Probably not. You can't be afraid to say, I've changed. I've evolved. When I talk to people, I talk about what we're doing now. He says one of the biggest things he brings to the town council is an open-minded and responsive attitude. He has a record of serving under mayors from both sides of the spectrum, focusing on practical local issues. It's a trait that may serve him well in the coming years as political fights become more heated. He says what needs to be considered is good governance. We can't rest on rhetoric. We can't rest on fear. We can't rest on whatever the Supreme Court is doing this month. It's not those issues are not important, but at the local level, we affect people's lives the most. Smith has a broad coalition of support, including the Wake County Democratic Party, although it has not officially endorsed him, and three of his former opponents, Mary Inspucker, Amanda Murphy, and George McDowell. Smith says, fundamentally, we were pretty much on the same page. In the end, when somebody says, I'm for the environment, I get to say, yes, so am I, and this is what we've done. During his time on the city council, Smith prioritized diversity in hiring, supported Project Phoenix, in which police officers were assigned to work with specific apartment communities, and helped launch Cary's Sister City program, which promotes cultural festivals and education. Smith also helped create Cary's affordable housing plan and fund that effort with $10 million in this year's budget. He says, I want to make sure that every citizen in Cary enjoys all the benefits that Cary has to offer, not just the wealthy, affluent neighborhoods. You can talk all you want about quality of life, but if you don't feel safe, or if you feel intimidated, or if you feel uncomfortable, then we're kind of losing the essence of what we're all about. And that's to be welcoming and inclusive to all. And the at-large race, we have Ken George. George, who previously served on the town council from 2015 to 19, is a fiscal conservative who says one of his top priorities is keeping property taxes low. Cary's recent boom means some property owners have seen a 14% tax hike, he says. George also takes issues with the increase in the price of Cary's downtown park, a project that was initially projected to cost $50 million. Voters approved a bond in 2019 that included funding for the park, but the town recently upped its estimate to around $69 million, a move George calls a bait and swap. Another of George's priorities is affordable housing, he says. Cary has grown massively in recent years, with Apple planning to renovate a 7-floor office building and Epic Games building its new headquarters in the dilapidated Cary Town Center. Development downtown has also skyrocketed with the Fenton mixed-use development on Cary Town Boulevard and a new sports complex planned for Buck Jones Road. Activists with One Wake, a community nonprofit lobbying for more investment in affordable housing, are worried that rising housing costs and property tax will lead to a long-term residents being displaced. In response to a survey by that group, George pledged to maintain the current level of funding for affordable housing. He also wants to expand the city's home repair grant. That's a program to include renovations for in-house rental units and accessory dwelling units, or granny flats, that would come with a guarantee of reduced rent for 30 years. These units would help fixed-income homeowners earn rent, George says, as well as give the city more affordable housing options. In addition to subsidizing these units, George wants the city to waive development fees, which can be anywhere from $15,000 to $20,000. He says, we have a large number of houses in Cary that are not part of a homeowners association that would prohibit a garage apartment, for instance. I want to make it so school teachers, firefighters, people who need workforce housing can rent from somebody in the neighborhood. We've already got the infrastructure in place. We can get more density without having to plow down a lot of trees. Also in that race, then, is Carissa Johnson. If Johnson wins, a liberal voice would replace Urhaus' moderate position, leading to a group of three solid Democrats on the council. The town council already voted unanimously in favor of an affordable housing plan and a non-discrimination ordinance, but Johnson could influence the council to lead more aggressively on issues of development and social justice. She's a first-time candidate, and she says the housing affordability crisis was what made her want to run for office. She knows what it's like to be uncertain about where you're living, she says. During the 2007 and 8 recession, I got laid off, she says, and didn't get a job very quickly. I had to have two or three jobs to make ends meet. I know what it feels like to lay in bed wondering where in the world my daughter and I are going to be in a month or two. It is a visceral ache. It makes everything feel unsettled. Johnson says the town council needs to do more work to fund affordable housing, especially as federal and state dollars eventually dry up. She also wants the town to relax zoning regulation to allow for more dense and diverse housing types instead of just single-family homes. The mixed-income project on Southeast Maynard Road is another good example of what the town should pursue, she says. That development includes 130 rental units, half of which are market rate and half of which are reserved for affordable housing. That project is a partnership between the town and a nonprofit. She also supports green building standards and solar power housing, which she says will both attract higher income individuals and support lower utilities for people in need. On social justice, Johnson says Cary needs to have a, quote, proper Pride Month celebration and should work to hire and hear from the town's Asian and Hispanic communities. The town has a responsibility to reflect the values of its residents, she says. And to close this article, for all candidates, the biggest fight is to get people to turn out and vote. Spreading the word that an election is happening in the middle of summer is no easy feat, especially when many eligible voters are on vacation, enjoying the beach and simply not thinking about politics yet because it's not November. Johnson says, half my battle is getting people to understand there is a runoff election. A significant number of people have congratulated me on my win, and I have to tell them I didn't win. Because in Cary, it's a nonpartisan race. You have to get 50% plus one vote. And Smith agrees. We just got to get people to remember there's another election in the middle of summer, he says. And a sidebar to this says early voting will run through July 23. On weekdays, people can vote from 8 a.m. to 7:30 p.m. You can also cast your ballot July 17th from 1 to 6 p.m. and July 23rd from 8 to 3 p.m. Election day is July 26th from 6:30 a.m. to 7:30 p.m. Where can you vote? Herbert Young Community Center on Wilkinson Avenue in Cary, Wake County Board of Elections on North New Hope Road in Raleigh. Or you can find your election day voting site at vt.ncsbe.gov. And the Indy Week endorsements, District C, Jack Smith, At-Large, Carissa Johnson, and for the Wake County Sheriff Democratic primary, Willie Rowe, W-O-R-O-W-E. Again from Durham. New school in town. The summer weather is heating up, and so is development of the Durham School of the Arts' new campus in North Durham. At a June 9th work session, Durham Public Schools board members approved a $490,000 contract with O'Brien Atkins Associates and Perkins and Will Design Firms for the pre-design and planning of a new DSA campus at 2900 Duke Homestead Road. The school will continue to serve grades 6 through 12, but will increase capacity to 2,000 students. It will be located on a tract of land purchased from Duke University for $4 million in 2010. Construction funding for the new school will be voted on as part of the November bond referendum. The current budget for the school is $120 million, but that amount may be revised based on the current construction market, said Frederick Davis, Durham Public Schools Executive Director of Building Service. Meanwhile, school system leaders say they are weighing several different educational uses for the current DSA campus in downtown Durham. School board member Natalie Beyer says, I think it's important for us as we plan for that site going forward to make sure it does have an educational use and that we take the time to deeply involve the community because it's a unique public space with a lot of deep history. The Magnet Arts School's current sprawling college-like campus occupies three blocks of a key area of Durham between North Duke and Gregson Streets. The site was originally home to Durham High School, built in 1906. In 1993, the school closed down, and 2 years later, DSA took over the left-behind space. However, an October study by NEMA management deemed the school in need of renovation or complete reconstruction due to crumbling infrastructure, accessibility issues, and traffic problems. Davis says, we know historically DSA was not built or designed to be a true performing arts and creative thinking school. It was just an idea, and we had an abandoned building at the time. Davis said the space could potentially be used as administrative offices and extra classroom space for overcrowded local schools like New Tech High School, a public magnet school with a STEM focus, and Ignite Online Academy, a new school providing hybrid learning for grades K through 12. Alternatively, the site could serve elementary schools also on the docket for revamping. Alongside DSA, Holt, Moorhead, Club Boulevard, Mangum, Bethesda, and Glen elementary schools were determined to need renovation and are included in that bond referendum. The school board is considering moving these elementary schools into DSA buildings while renovations are underway so education is not interrupted. The school's downtown location is both prime real estate and a historic site that community members treasure. Many parents welcome improved facilities, but some worry about the loss of the DSA downtown location. Not only is the new campus less accessible to students living in the city and southern Durham, but the downtown location is an important part of what the school is, said DSA parent Sammy Banawan. Quote, I think putting DSA in the middle of Durham really increases awareness of the school itself. They're moving away from what I think makes DSA an interesting and unique campus. Banawan and others are concerned that the move could bring a loss of social and arts opportunities. The transition to a new, more suburban campus will potentially end the long-standing relationship between the school and the bustling downtown, he said. Taking those concerns into account, O'Brien Atkins and DPS administrators will engage with administration and community to develop a vision for the new school, said Davis. The pre-design process will last at least until the end of August, and construction on the new school will likely begin in June or July of 2023. Construction will take an estimated 18 to 24 months, with a goal of completion in June 2025 in time for the new school year. Pre-design will be followed by a detailed design work, including site plans, floor plans, and elevations. The school system will then solicit construction bids for the new campus. Davis said, no activity on this site is going to happen for at least another year or so. Once designs are drafted, they will be shown to the community ahead of the bond referendum. This means community engagement and approval are vital to the design process, said Beyer. Quote, I think it will take time and input from students and teachers specifically to think entirely outside the box about that school. Not just what it has been, but more what it can be. Now from Byron Woods on the stage column, but it's about an opera company. A young Raleigh opera company is determined to make the music form more accessible. And Woods writes, Alyssa Rocha is a very rare thing, a maverick soprano. And since she is, we're getting an unconventional new opera company devoted to emerging artists, new music, and intriguing takes on older works in its first performances across the Triangle this weekend. Paradox Opera. It's a brainchild born out of a generation of artists' frustration with the outdated aesthetics of privilege cemented in the art form's conventional training and practices. The opera bows this weekend in its first production, COVID Chronicles, a decidedly accessible and broad-ranging concert cabaret, taking stock of how much the world and we have changed after 2 years in a pandemic. The company's next work, Autonomy, a cycle of newly commissioned songs on Roe versus Wade, coming this fall. The path to create a new opera company in the region, one particularly devoted to changes long needed in the genre, hasn't been easy. After a 12-year career as a coloratura who'd worked with professional companies including the Dallas and Miami operas, Roca moved to the region in 2020. She wasn't looking for a career reset. She'd concluded that opera desperately needed a reset as an art form instead, saying, "Opera is dying because the audience is dying." Despite a long decline in ticket sales at most opera houses, she notes, "It's very exclusionary. It's museum culture on all fronts. The industry is extremely gatekeeping for the audience as well as the singers. The big hitters right now are not interested in pitching things to younger people and making things accessible. I've been through the whole of the industry, and it's very uncommon to find people who encourage you to do something different." The legendary stage director Peter Brook reached that same conclusion decades ago. In his 1968 book titled The Empty Space, Brook wrote that opera, quote, "is a nightmare of vast feuds over tiny details that all turn around the same assertion, nothing needs to change." According to Roca, that dynamic hasn't changed. Quote, "There's this overwhelming idea that that kind of music has to be done one way, and if it's not done that way, it's wrong." She asserts that constrictive traditional aesthetics have all but straight-jacketed opera students, and women in particular. She recalls a harrowing collegiate competition performance during her first year in college where the judges tore her work to shreds. "They had no criticism of Roca's singing," she recalls. "They were simply distressed that she had made a single hand gesture during her performances." Quote, "I think audiences feel we're just sort of puzzle parts in someone else's museum piece. I've been told so many times in my academic career, just stand there and be the pretty girl in the dress. What is that crap?" After that experience, she began pushing back against the conventions in her training, saying, "I was very much the anomaly among the singers. I just told people no, and that was weird." When her graduate vocal teacher assigned her repertory works, Roca brought in new music by new composers. "He sort of gave up," she said, "and just said, okay, what are you doing?" She's forged her own path ever since. "It's funny. My whole career, basically, has just been me walking up to an ensemble or group and saying, I'm doing this, I'm going to produce it, and here it is." To test that proposition even further, Rosa started Paradox Opera during the pandemic, assembling a board of directors and reaching out to longtime colleagues to get things underway. The company and its work represent a series of departures from business as usual in the opera world. The focus and subject matter are clearly present tense. The production logos, which merge graffiti with edgy graphic novel sensibilities, are clearly pitched to a younger audience. In another divergence from the industry, the production is more cabaret than recital. A multifaceted compilation of 19 works, ranging from Mozart to Stephen Sondheim, with new composers given prominence alongside canon stalwarts, including Verdi, Rossini, and Saint-Saëns. Among the set, pensive takes on isolation and loss from recent chamber operas like William Finn's A New Brain and Jason Robert Brown's The Last 5 Years, contrast with irreverent updates of Gilbert and Sullivan, and excerpts from Lend Me a Roll, Vince Grover's unlikely pandemic farce on the toilet paper crisis of 2020. Roca grins. It's not just like, okay, come in here and be depressed for 90 minutes. To have all these different stories, probably everyone in the audience will have something that happened to them that fits in some of these boxes. Also, the group won't present its music in an exclusive downtown opera house to overdressed swells in black tie and evening dress. After live streaming Thursday night on Twitch TV, the quartet takes its unconventional show to equally unconventional venues, a three-night tour of churches in Raleigh, Durham, and Hillsboro. Grass is casual, they say, come as you are. Offstage, the company has departed from the norm as well. Soloists rarely have the opportunity to choose the work they perform in public. Here, the music reflects the taste and aesthetics of the artist on stage. Old friends, Roca called on for her company's first show, including the Chicago-based mezzo Melissa Simmons, baritone Christopher Fotis from Brooklyn, and the composer and pianist Rachel Dean, who is currently in Broadway's Moulin Rouge. Future productions will draw on local artists, notes Roca. Quote, I want to give back power to the artists so they feel like they're really a part of what's being created. The headstrong singer and producer wants her artist to have the opportunity to say what they want to say, not what somebody else tells them they want to say. If I can, and I have to, she concludes, I can pave the way. And this again refers to these live performances of Paradox Opera, which are as follows. Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Raleigh, July 16, 7 p.m. St. Paul's Lutheran Church, Durham, July 17, 7 p.m. St. Matthew's Episcopal Church, Hillsboro, July 19, 7 p.m. Their website, paradoxopera.org/COVID-Chronicles. Now, I have enough time to begin an article from an etc. column written by Hannah Kaufman called Stranger Than Fiction. At first glance, Big Hole Road appears to be an ordinary dusty country road, the kind of dead-end street the wrong turn might lead you down if you're lost in Pittsburgh. But if that wrong turn takes you farther down Big Hole Road, you might notice that some of the houses along the road seem a little out of place, mismatched and clashing in a world of homeowners association and uniform suburbia. You might also wonder why the road is empty, despite it being the middle of the day. The lure of this place, though, doesn't lie along the road, but at the end of it, where you'll be met with an empty guard box, a warning sign with a blaring red font, and a tall barbed wire gate adorned with the AT&T logo. Dig a little deeper, 7 stories deep even, and you might find a giant, secretive underground bunker that stretches somewhere below the site's 191 acres of property. You might need a pretty big shovel. Like Nancy Wheeler, one of the characters in the wildly popular Netflix show Stranger Things, I'm an intern at a local paper trying to get a start in the world of journalism. Unlike Nancy Wheeler, though, my editors actually gave me the chance to explore stories. Stranger Things is the creative brainchild of identical twins, Matt and Ross Duffer, who were born and raised in Durham. If you pay careful attention through this show's four seasons, the Duffer Brothers have hidden North Carolina Easter eggs throughout the entire show, including the layout of the show's fictional town of Hawkins, Indiana, with identical streets to Durham names like Curley and Cornwallis, bodies of water named Jordan Lake and Eno River, and a direct reference to Durham in season number four. The brothers have confirmed many of these details as being influenced by their childhood, but have provided little information on the inspiration behind Hawkins Lab, the creepy government building at the center of the plot. That is where this assignment on Big Hole, an underground facility located in Chatham County, comes in. Named after the not-so-subtle 75-foot hole dug in the ground during construction, it is rumored to be several stories deep, while atop its grassy surface sit a few oddly shaped buildings, huge security cameras, and antennae. The entirety of the facility is surrounded by barbed wire fence and no trespassing signs. The site dates back to the 1960s when AT&T built five central facilities as part of the Project Offices program. Within this confidential program, they built and maintained several structurally sound facilities along the east coast of the United States in the mid-20th century for an ongoing non-public project. In addition to Big Hole, these facilities were also constructed inside various northeastern mountains. And much of the rest of this article has some no comments from various political and AT&T ex-employees. But I have reached the end of my allotted time span. We'd like to thank you for listening to Indie Week, also available online at indieweek.com with some updated stories, but I didn't even have time to get to those today. Because there's our mysterious background music to close the Indie Week for this week. John Federson is bidding you all farewell and saying you can rehear this broadcast, a podcast, go to the podcast section of ncreadingservice.org. Thank you very much for listening, and bye-bye.